From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1493 when Italian voyager Christopher Columbus had the publication of many of his letters and diary entries about his voyages. And in his own words, he described the people he had encountered. Quote, "They do not carry arms, nor are they acquainted with them, because I showed them some swords, and they took them by the edge and through ignorance cut themselves. They have no iron. Their javelins are shafts without iron, and some of them have at the end a fish tooth and other things. They should be good and intelligent servants." End quote. If Columbus's first encounter with the indigenous people was relatively calm, his next voyage was decidedly not. He returned with a force of men ready to, if need be, enslave these people, forcing them to produce gold and even taking some young girls as sexual slaves. That was just the start. Thousands upon thousands would die violently or by disease. And yet here we are in 2014, celebrating a federal holiday called Columbus Day. In several American cities, most recently Seattle, that's changing. Seattle passed an order to stop celebrating Columbus Day and to instead celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day. So how should we teach American children about Columbus and when? And should Western New York join the movement away from Columbus Day as a holiday? My guest for the hour in studio is Peter Jemison. He's the site manager of the Gunnonaggan State Historic Site. Peter, nice to have you.
Thank you, Evan.
Peter is also a member of the Seneca Nation. Nice to have you here in studio. On the phone with us, we've got Ray Crabe. He's a history professor at Cornell University. Ray, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
John Schwaller is on the line with us, history professor at SUNY Albany. John, thanks for being here.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
And John, I also want to let our listeners know, at least from what I can tell, you're working on a book about some of the subsequent people who were part of some of that colonization process. Is that right, John?
Yeah, I just finished a book on the conquest of Mexico by Cortez and his followers, and I'm in the midst of a book right now on one of the Aztec months.
Okay, so that's sort of a broad overview here, and if you want to join the conversation about what we know and what we teach about Columbus, you can do that here on the program, online or by phone. But first, let me get back to Seattle. Seattle Mayor Ed Murray made a comment at the signing ceremony in which they agreed that they would not honor Columbus Day anymore and they would change it to Indigenous Peoples Day. And this is just a short comment, if I could, from Seattle Mayor Ed Murray. Dave, do we have the comment from the Seattle mayor? Let's grab that and let's listen to what Ed Murray said at the signing ceremony.
I hope that today is not just simply a day of recognition, but also a moment of healing.
So let me ask Peter Jemison, again, a member of the Seneca Nation and the site manager of Gunnonaggan State Historic Site. When you hear what Seattle is doing, making this change, and they're talking about healing, yes or no? Is healing possible, and do you support that?
Well, I think, you know, this is Columbus Day is our sort of only the beginning of a series of things that unfold, and much of them really unfold because of papal bulls that are, I guess, issued both in 1493 and previous to that in 1452, which really frame sort of the concept for the doctrine of discovery. That is that a crown can claim land by virtue of, you know, quote, explorers landing where there are no Christians, and they can begin to dominate these people who are enemies of Christ or who may be of some other belief, some other faith, or considered pagans. So this Columbus Day is kind of like sort of an isolated thing, and Christopher Columbus is a bit of an isolated event, although he certainly, you know, was part of the, you know, of this cycle that began, you know, this craze for gold and all of the events that sort of unfold from that. So the healing, I think, has to take into account what the product of the papal bulls was, and you know, a decision by a chief justice named Marshall in 1823 that involves this idea that we had no ownership over the land. Native people had no ownership over the land, and therefore it can be claimed by another crown. You know, so that is the part that I think is the part that sort of needs to be unpacked and really examined, and for its impact, not only historically, but for its impact even today in terms of Native people.
before we get to, and I want to get to our two professors on the line, I also want to share some thoughts from a history professor at the University of Rochester. I spoke this morning to Pablo Sierra, who teaches history at the University of Rochester, and I wanted to get his perspective on not only what he teaches his students, but some of their reaction based on their prior education about Columbus. So let's listen to this brief interview with history professor Pablo Sierra at the University of Rochester.
When I usually teach colonial Latin America, it's during the fall, so it's perfect because Columbus Day frequently comes up. And the point is to let the students make their own decisions as to how they evaluate and think of Christopher Columbus. This is an excerpt from his diary, what I usually give him. And it's a priceless document because it actually gives us his own words and descriptions of the people he's encountering. And I think that really opens up the students' minds to this man's mindset, not just his accolades. And that's what I really want them to do.
In that entry, what exactly is Christopher Columbus saying?
He's describing these inhabitants, these Taino people that he's finding in the Caribbean, and he's gauging how dangerous they are, how profitable they could be. Physically, he's never quite seen people like them, so he's trying to situate them for European perspective. For instance, he says, they're not quite black, they're not quite white, they're the color of the Canarian, right? And so you realize, oh, for a European sailor, the Canaries have a very specific meaning. So he's trying to write a text that will allow Europe to understand what he's seeing in the Caribbean for the first time.
He's also concluding that he doesn't think they would be difficult to either conquer, or he's sort of hinting at what is to come in terms of how easily manipulated or controlled they might be.
Yes, and he's very explicit in that. He says, they do not carry arms. They're not acquainted with arms. I showed them swords. They cut themselves out of ignorance with them. So it's very evident to him that this is a population that can be subdued very easily. And that's kind of shocking to my students, right? Because we think of him as crossing the ocean blue and planting the flag of Spain. We don't think that on that same first day he's going to think, oh, I can overtake these people with 20 guys. That tends to shock an undergrad who has never heard this kind of history and from the horse's mouth. So it's very effective in that sense. There's certainly a profit motive, but the other thing we need to take in mind is what's actually happening that year, 1492. The Jewish population of Spain is being expelled by royal decree. The last Muslim kingdom is falling to the Castilians. It's really a momentous time, and there's certainly we have a very clear understanding that Columbus is not exceptional in this regard. He's doing this for Catholicism. He's sailing across the ocean to reclaim new lands for God. And in this way, he's pretty standard, actually.
And briefly, Latin American nations take a variety of approaches to this. Dia de la Raza, some of them celebrate, my understanding is, some kind of cultural diversity or racial appreciation day. What's happening in the Latin American world when it comes to what we have known as Columbus Day?
Dia de la Raza came around in the early 20th century as a way of contesting this idea that, you know, Latin Americans owe everything to Europe. And their way of doing that is saying, well, this day that traditionally has been used to celebrate this Genoese explorer, we're going to use it as a day to celebrate indigenous cultures. And I can't tell you that it's actually a popular holiday. It kind of goes pretty much undetected. It's just not celebrating someone who we don't think very highly of. And this is similar, for instance, in Mexico. You cannot find a statue for Hernan Cortes. You cannot. And he is by far one of the most important historical figures for Mexican folk, but he is not to be celebrated. And I think Columbus pretty much falls along those same lines.
That's Pablo Sierra, professor of history at the University of Rochester. Professor Schwaller in Albany, let me ask you, do your students have the same surprise that Professor Sierra is describing when it comes to understanding the actual events as opposed to sort of kind of the, for lack of a better term, the elementary school education that we've been getting on Christopher Columbus?
Well, needless to say, we all present it somewhat differently.
Yeah.
And I present it as part of this expansion of Christianity on the Iberian Peninsula. Professor Sierra mentioned that the voyage of Columbus does coincide with the reconquest of the Iberian Peninsula from the Muslims, which was a politically motivated event on the part of the queen and the king in order to galvanize public attention at home. In Spain, they had just gone through a disastrous civil war between the nobility contesting whether or not Isabel could even be queen. So what I do is I look at it in this larger context. It grows rather directly out of the Reconquest in Spain. And the most curious thing about Columbus, and as my colleague pointed out, he really is an exemplar of his time. The most curious thing about Columbus is what he was trying to prove. He was not trying to prove that the world was round. Anybody who had any reason to have an opinion on that matter knew that the world was round. The debate was actually how big. Since the time of the Greeks, folks had assumed that it was around 24 to 25,000 miles in circumference. Columbus comes along saying, no, it's much smaller. It's only about 18,000 miles in circumference, and besides which, the Eurasian continent is much bigger than anybody has ever said. So just by sailing 3,000 miles in open ocean, you could actually get to the east coast of Asia. So that to me was, that for me is an important part of the discussion, especially since traditionally people have been, told that he was proving the world was round. Well, no, sorry. Doesn't work that way.
Professor Crabb at Cornell University, what are your impressions of what students generally know coming in on this subject?
I think students generally, not surprisingly, take a position that's either intensely influenced by the kind of elementary basic overview of Columbus that they get, whether it be from films or from a school education, or they have a very intensely negative position. Right, which is completely understandable in many respects. I think what oftentimes is difficult when you're teaching sort of early Latin America, the early Americas, is to get students to get out of the framework of seeing Columbus as the sole kind of generator of history, that there's a huge array of people who are acting and performing and participating in the process that we know of and will come to know as colonization. And so part of the struggle is to not sort of completely annihilate the positions that they come into the room with, but to get them to try to think about historicizing Columbus, understanding not just Columbus, but the entire process of encounter or invasion and conquest in a kind of longer process, as part of a longer process, and getting them to think about the ways in which the sort of Old Testament narrative of good and evil doesn't necessarily work when you're talking about most human beings. It works for mythologies, and certainly Columbus has been mythologized, and it facilitates this kind of good and evil narrative. But it's important to get them to think much more concretely, and I try to use a lot of kind of contemporary comparative moments to get them to think about these things in a more critical fashion.
Professor Ray, when it comes to what we teach kids at what age, we can't sort of make a blanket statement. I mean, school districts and classroom to classroom may be different, but I don't know if it's changed from when I was growing up. I mean, it was certainly sort of a sugar-coated history of Columbus when I was growing up. Is that changing at the lower levels, and should it? Should we grapple with some of these issues with kids at a younger age, as opposed to just kind of making them sing songs? I mean, here's Jake writing into us saying, I personally believe children should be taught the truth from as early an age as possible. You don't need to go into extreme details, but it's a simple lesson to explain to children how different the world was back then. And we don't have to just say that everything was rosy, that everyone was happy. Ray, what do you think when it comes to the way we teach kids from a younger age?
Yeah, it's a good question, in part because I have three young kids, and things have clearly changed. I mean, they're all three of them. The narrative of Columbus they have is that, he was a pretty bad guy. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing at all. I think it's obviously got it's got its issues. As they grow older, they have to think about him again in a broader context, and they have to think about the kind of collective enterprises that were undertaken. They have to think about the ways in which, even the ways you think about the past, how you think about history and the historical process. But certainly, I mean, it's the idea that you would continue to or you would shield young children from the kinds of realities of the past and the realities of history that are there, seems to me very problematic. I think kids deserve a lot more credit than we give them when it comes to making sense of historical processes, making sense of how you might compare something that's happening now with something that happened in the past, seeing the continuity, seeing the differences, but also thinking very, I mean, we're talking from Cornell University, which is a university that occupies native land, and the idea that in Ithaca, the school district would not, I mean, the idea that it would not, in some sense or another, take on Columbus in a critical fashion seems a bit ironic. And so I'm, at least from my perspective, I'm glad that my own children in their education are being confronted with that.
Professor Schwaller, here's an email from a listener named Ann who says, Evan and I grew up in Monroe County, won't tell you which school district, but I grew up feeling like when I finally understood the story of Christopher Columbus, I had been lied to at an early age. I don't think children should be given all of the gory details, but at the same time, we don't need to lie to them. That creates a misunderstanding of history at an early age, and often it never gets corrected. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, most professional historians are going to agree with that wholeheartedly. The concern, of course, 19th century, there was a hagiography of Columbus. Columbus became larger than life. He became this grand exemplar of the discoverer. We named our nation's capital after him. Republics in South America are named after him. But we failed to look at the full picture. And obviously, as historians, we want folks to take the time to analyze the full picture, to see that there are a lot of forces at work here. My colleague mentioned the papal bulls. Certainly, the papacy itself has a part in assisting the Spanish and Portuguese crowns in their desires to find trade routes in the exterior. They sweetened the pot by saying that you can have political control over those areas. I will point out that the papacy in 1536 then said that the natives of the New World are human beings and are eligible to receive all the sacraments of the church and must be treated in a manner which is appropriate for human beings. So that kind of took care of that issue. And at least in the Spanish world, for instance, after 1542, at least the laws said that you could not enslave Indians. They were still mistreated, don't get me wrong, but there is at least a legal structure that's coming into place. These are the nuances of history that I think we as professional historians would like for students to become accustomed to earlier on. It's not black and white. There are no easy answers. There are no real heroes. There are no real villains. Most of us wallow around somewhere in the middle.
Right. And you know, interestingly enough, there was sort of this online movement that started about a year ago to change the notion of Columbus Day to Bartolomé de las Casas. And you know, I mean, it was fascinating to see how much traction that got. You have, again, written about people who followed Columbus in different places there. So I guess what I'm asking is this, John, when it comes to that notion of the world lives in the black, doesn't live in black and white, the world lives in gray, Columbus may have been a man of his time. He may have been a man looking for gold and treasure and to promote his religion and to enslave the people he found for his own gain. And it's probably true that most people in his position would have done that. But that doesn't absolve him completely because there are others who were much more interested in preserving human rights. Is that fair to say?
Well, and certainly you mentioned Las Casas. He's an interesting example because he was part of the later Columbus voyages. Ultimately became a priest and then eventually became a Dominican friar. And he had one of those transitional moments in which he realized that the policies of the Spanish government at that point were not Christian, and that he really needed to speak out and to preach against the mistreatment of the Indians. I think it shows that within the society at the time, there was this kind of give and play. I mean, all of the conquistadors did not wear helmets and carry swords and slaughter babies, and there was a very active debate going on in the halls of power in Spain as to how best to treat the human rights of native peoples. But at the same time, we've got to remember that this is the 16th century, and people looked at things very, very differently than we do today. And so certainly as historians, that's the other thing that we try and do, is assist our students to understand that the actors in what we are studying came into the discussions with very, very different basic assumptions than we do today.
Peter Jemison, let me turn it back to you, a member of the Seneca Nation and the site manager of the Ganondagan State Historic Site. First of all, I know you want to weigh in on what you're hearing. Go ahead.
Yeah, my comment is really that what I spoke about earlier, say in the Marshall decision, you know, Marshall versus McIntosh, you know, what you have there are, excuse me, the Marshall decision in the McIntosh case, what you have there is, again, this idea that we could not possess the land, that we had no concepts of possession of land, that we had no right to the ownership of the soil, even though we're the occupants of it, and that we were discovered. I mean, that's the part that really lingers with us yet today, is that, law is based on basically this notion that another group of people could come here, discover this land, lay claim to it, and that claim could be legitimate. So regardless of whatever debates were taking place, the reality is that remains with us as a notion, and that law, you know, as we understand it, as it's practiced in this country all the way to the Supreme Court, uses as its basis Christianity. You know, this is an idea that in some way, justice is not blind. If you have a different belief system, remember that those who are making decisions about you are guided by, something that is established in Christian tradition, and something that is established that takes place as a result of papacy bulls and so forth. This, you know, this remains with us, and I think it up to the date when people make a ruling in the case of the Oneida versus Sherrill, the township of Sherrill, and again they invoke the doctrine of discovery. So this is 1995. So that's what I'm referring to when I'm saying that, you know, we need to unpack this whole story, and it has its origins back at a time period when Columbus is traveling and coming across the seas here. And then those who subsequently follow, and of course we know it's involving English, it's involving French, it's involving the Dutch, you know, all of them looking for a foothold in this country. Then it starts to involve the founding fathers who are land speculators. So then you got Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, all the rest of them, you know, looking for them for a way to gain lands that are, you know, beyond the original boundaries of the 13 original states. So, you know, this is a long history, and it's a very complicated history of it. We're really just scratching the surface here, you know, at a very early part of this. And it's that much more complicated history that on one level we expect fourth graders to understand. We in New York State schools, the history of the Haudenosaunee, of the Iroquois Confederacy, is taught in the fourth grade. There may be a little touch on it in the seventh grade, and beyond that, almost nothing at all. So we're asking fourth graders to understand this, and how in the world do we give them the context from which they would have to understand this? On the one hand, they could understand who are the Six Nations, let's say that. They could understand, you know, the territories perhaps that they occupied in New York State historically. How that land base diminishes, how land companies, how preemption rights, how all of the rest of this stuff happens, you know, is you can spend your lifetime trying to unravel these things as a historian. And so, you know, what can we teach fourth graders? What can we teach elementary school students? Yes, we have to teach them an element of truth, and we have to try to make it so that, you know, we're not trying to frighten them. We're not trying to bully them or make them feel bad, really. What we're trying to do is introduce truth, I think, into this conversation.
All right, so a couple of points there, though, Peter. You're saying go ahead and introduce those elements of truth. Don't sort of sugarcoat it early on, mm-hmm. but don't give up on teaching these concepts, especially with the way students in this state understand Indian history and yeah. et cetera. If you leave it there at fourth grade, don't expect it to flower. Don't expect it to develop. So as a member of the Seneca Nation, what did you grow up learning about Columbus?
I really, you've got to remember that I'm old enough to have been in school in the 1950s, and Christopher Columbus is treated as an explorer, as a hero of some sort, who discovered America. And he proved that the world was not flat. That's kind of like right. how simple this stuff was that we were...
Well, simple and basic, wrong.
Simple and wrong, yes. I mean, it takes a long time to really, to fully understand, the context that Christopher Columbus comes from and the world that he lived in. I was mentioning to you earlier, Evan, that I went to school at the University of Siena. There was absolutely no mention of Christopher Columbus. And we're studying Italian history. We're studying the Renaissance. We're studying the time period, which leads into this. And there's really no mention of the development of the weaponry. There's no mention of the development of the sailing ships. There's no mention of the goal of reaching another world for gold and all of the rest of that. I mean, it's being presented to us as, again, people like the Medici's, people like the Borgias are all, they're simply the families with the wealth to support the art and the architecture and so forth. So we wound up focusing on that realm.
Well, and Peter mentioned spending time in Italy. I was talking to Peter before the hour started, and I said, look, I'm trying to understand people who will get very defensive about the notion of losing Columbus Day, mm-hmm. substituting indigenous people or Dia de la Raza or whatever you want to call it. And, we started the hour by mentioning that Seattle has changed this year. They are now celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day. They are not celebrating Columbus Day in Seattle anymore. Minneapolis City Council has renamed Columbus Day Indigenous Peoples Day as well. South Dakota celebrates Native American Day in remembrance of the great Native American leaders who contributed so much history in that state. Hawaii observes Discoverer's Day, in which Polynesian explorers are honored. So there are all these things happening, and I'm wondering, who is against this? Well, I'd like to play just a brief clip. The one I found most immediately was on Fox News. Joe Piscopo, the actor who led the New York City parade, says, you cannot take Columbus Day away, especially for Italian Americans. Here's him talking to one of the Fox News hosts. Let's listen.
Don't take our heritage away, Neil. They always nail Italian Americans. We're always portrayed as stereotypical gangsters. This came from an anti-Catholic movement in the 19th century. That's what, and it just kind of snowballed. Italians are the most patriotic people of all. Don't take it.
But this is Seattle, Joe. I mean, nothing against Seattle. Wonderful city. Very caffeinated.
We came here with the Italians and the Jews and in the turn of the 19th to 20th century. We built the United States of America. And if we want a holiday in the name of an explorer who was brave enough to look for the new world, then we should have it.
Okay. He's saying we should have it there. Peter, what do you think when you hear that?
Well, first of all, I have nothing against the Italian heritage. I have nothing against Italian
people. Again, you spent time there, yes.
I lived in Italy. I went to Italy because I wanted to understand more about people that I actually grew up with, in America. Many of whom did not really have a very strong connection to their heritage. So many people were encouraged to, as they said, join the melting pot and become an American and forget about any heritage that you had. And, I had a burning interest in art and art history and actually Italian people at that particular time. And so living in Siena for me was a wonderful experience. Learned a great deal, actually learned to be able to use the language, to be able to communicate with my family that I live with, which spoke no English. So, this is, to me, I can understand, that people want to have something that they feel a strong allegiance to, that they feel, someone they might be able to say is an admirable person. I think that, when we really get into the story of Columbus, there are things that we discover, as was said earlier by the others on the phone, that are not particularly the kind of thing you want to be proud of because of the of you know of their acts and of the acts of the people that they brought to this part of the world.
Well, maybe we should ask if we have any listeners of Italian descent, if you agree with Joe Piscopo that this is all about taking Italian heritage away. Let's grab a phone call. This is Thomas in Greece. Thomas, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you for your show. It's an interesting topic. I believe I did read where Columbus, he took four voyages to, well, the New World, as it was called, and then he, the last time he came back in chains, I believe because it was Queen Isabella who had him confined in chains or arrested or something because she disapproved of his enslavement of the native people. Is that true?
Let me start by asking Professor Schwaller. Go ahead.
Not really. It was more of a political issue, as these things often are. When Columbus contracted with the crown to sail to the New World, the queen became the guarantor for the expedition, which means that if everything was lost, she would pay off all of his creditors. And in order to firm up this deal, they actually signed a contract. Which we know as the Contract of Santa Fe, named after a little town in southern Spain. And in it, the queen offered to support the voyage, and she gave various rights and privileges to Columbus were he to be successful. But the fine print said that you have to get the short route to the Indies, that is, to Asia. And by 1500, it was patently clear to everyone except Columbus that while, yes, he had discovered something, it was not Asia. And so the Spanish crown felt that he was in violation of the contract and that they were no longer responsible for supporting him. He was given the position of viceroy, of governor, for all of the lands that he conquered. Well, he opposed the fact that the Spanish crown wanted to name their own governor, and they pointed out that he hadn't fulfilled the contract the way he said he had. So it was really more of a legal and a political dispute. Columbus was a bit high-handed once he was in government himself on the island of Española, what is now Santo Domingo. The issue of the enslavement of the natives was not an issue for Isabel, at least that I recall. It was not for another 20 or 30 years that this would become a major point of debate in the Spanish court.
Thomas, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does, and thank you for correcting me. And then maybe just briefly, I wanted to say that there's another old myth that she pawned her jewels to finance the voyage, which is not
right. True
now, I think, although maybe, I don't know how many people believe that.
Thanks. Thank you, Thomas. Thanks for thanks for the call there. Ray, she didn't, right? John, Ray, she didn't
pawn her jewels. No, she didn't.
Okay.
She served as guarantor. There were investors down in the towns where Columbus sailed from, who were willing to go along, but their problem was that if the ships were lost, that was a huge investment. And so she served as the guarantor should the ships be wrecked, and one of them was, that precipitated the second voyage, that the crown would stand behind the investment and make certain that people were made whole. The other thing is that she did allow Columbus to use materiel, that is ropes, sails, gunpowder, stuff like that, out of the royal armory, which was located there in southern Spain.
We are late for a break, and what I want to do is let's take a very short break. Let's ask our professors to hang in there, and we've got Peter Jemison here as well from Ganondagan. Your phone calls, if you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. I want to look at a kind of a broader issue that the New York Times just reported on. When we come back from the break, a question about something happening in Colorado, a student counter-protest to a curriculum that is meant to be more patriotic. The students say if you are all about patriotism, you can whitewash history to all of our detriment. We're going to talk a little bit about what's happening there and get the panel's response and much more on your thoughts about Columbus Day and what to celebrate. All of that coming up on Member Supported Public Radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Coming up Thursday on The Next Connections, we'll explore the question of who draws congressional and state legislature districts. That issue will be on the ballot in November. Then we'll sit down for the hour with Green Party candidate Howie Hawkins, running for governor. He'll explain his plans to guarantee a job for all citizens and why he thinks a $15 minimum wage is not a threat to business, but the answer. That's Thursday on Connections.
On The Next Fresh Air, why kids sext. We talk with Hannah Rosen, who writes about a teen sexting scandal in the November edition of The Atlantic. She says many teenagers who sext don't think about the possible consequences, but...
in most states, it's a felony because it's child pornography, so you can see the dilemma for law enforcement. What are they supposed to do?
Join us.
Tonight at 7...
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're talking about the question surrounding Columbus, the teaching of Columbus, and the time, the celebration of Columbus Day. You see Seattle and Minneapolis now moving away from Columbus Day. They're celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day instead. And I see a story in the New York Times in which, let me read briefly from Jack Healy's report, quote, a new conservative school board majority in the Denver suburbs recently, in Arvada, Colorado, recently proposed a curriculum review committee to promote patriotism, to promote respect for authority, and to promote free enterprise, and to guard against educational materials that could encourage or condone civil disorder. In response, hundreds of students in the Denver area, along with teachers and parents, are giving the board their own lesson in civil disobedience. They are protesting, saying, quote, from Griffin Guttermorson, a junior at a high school there, quote, it's gotten bad. The school board is insane here. You can't erase our history. That's not patriotic. That's stupidity. It's an interesting question, though, about what we teach and why. And Professor Krebe from Cornell University, what do you make of it when people start saying, look, we have to be careful with how we teach this because it could be viewed as anti-American. Whether it's Christopher Columbus or anything else, there's this view that we have to be careful to continue to promote patriotism alongside our history.
Yeah. I'm not sure that education is primarily or should be primarily designed to promote patriotism. That's the first question, and I think that's a big open question, and I think it's one that's been productively put on the table by the students and the teachers in Colorado, and I have to say I thank them for doing that. It's not clear to me that that's entirely what or largely what education should be about. I will briefly say I find it quite ironic that you have a school board that is championing the free enterprise system and yet is essentially sort of imposing this in a sort of top-down planning from above fashion. It does seem to me that there's a bit of an irony there. But I think it's a big question that they're raising, a lot of big questions that they're raising, and I think it goes to a crux of a lot of the things that we have to think about when we teach and practice history. One of them is wrestling very carefully and very critically with what I referred to earlier as sort of Old Testament narratives of good and evil, or what John referred to as sort of black and white kinds of narratives. I don't know many faculty or teachers anywhere that I've met in my lifetime who present things as blatantly good or bad. And I think that's a discredit to a lot of teachers in this country that the school board seems to insinuate that. The other thing I'll say is that there's a confusion, I think, sometimes amongst people who aren't trained to be teachers, who have not gone through the process of learning and participating and being credentialed to teach and so forth. And my understanding is that a number of people on the school board lack those credentials, for better or for worse. I believe in them. There's a confusion at times, or a conflation between objectivity and neutrality. And they have this perception that somehow all history needs to be neutral in some sense, and that equals objectivity, that you're an objective teacher and an objective faculty member if you are neutral about things. And, of course, that's enormously flawed as a way of thinking. None of us are neutral. We all carry with us an enormous amount of baggage, historical experience, perspectives, and opinions, and so forth. But we also, if we are good at what we do, we also abide by the criteria that we ourselves have established that we call objectivity. The things that we say count as evidence, for example. The things that we agree upon that that qualify as a good versus a bad interpretation. And those are the things, and of course those things are up for debate and those things are argued, but they're argued within a bandwidth, within a framework that most of us agree upon about what constitutes evidence, what constitutes research, and so on and so forth. And the problem is that neutrality and objectivity, I think, in the minds of some, at least, who have these positions around the teaching of anti-Americanism or something like this, which it certainly, I don't see it as anti-Americanism, but anyways, those things get conflated and they get confused. And it turns education and it turns the past and the present into nothing more than a kind of dog-eat-dog game of politics in terms of who can populate the school board at what point in time.
And I think
that seems to me enormously, enormously devastating for quality education, critical thinking amongst young people. And the thing about authority, I'll just say one last thing, sorry, and then I'll stop. You know, the thing about authority, that tells it right there. It gives it all away. Right? Teaching a lack of respect for authority. I mean, that whatever rationale there was for putting that into this series of criticisms, I can't make sense of. It seems to me that kids should have a pretty healthy critique and skepticism for authority. It seems to me that, in fact, there's a portion of our society, a large portion of our society, that in fact celebrates precisely that when it talks about Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or Silicon Valley or anti-government people. I mean, so there's a real issue here in terms of how those things are phrased, and I, again, I want to thank the teachers and students of Colorado for putting this stuff on the agenda.
Well, certainly, Ray, the American founders didn't have all that much respect for the authority over them at the time, but now they're viewed as... anyway, before I kick it over to Professor Schwaller, let me also sort of point out to Peter Jemison in the room here with me, here in our WXXI studios, that my observation is, Peter made a great point earlier this hour when he pointed out that in New York State, you're essentially done with it, with Native education in about fourth grade, that kids hear about American Indians and all this. It's kind of a cartoonish history and presentation, and then that's really it. It's sort of left behind. For me, I grew up in Ohio. That was largely true as well. I spent Western summers in Western New York, and I learned the Indian tribes because I worked at an outdoor camp there. But that was the extent of my education. Yeah. Whereas when it comes to, you look at what's happening in Colorado, as Ray's talking about the school board that wants to sort of whitewash or concern about, is it anti-patriotic to teach about some of the ugly parts of our past? Well, that's a great way to leave American Indian populations out of the discussion entirely, because in many ways we probably should be embarrassed, but refusing to teach that is somehow patriotic. I don't understand that at all.
Yeah. Well, I want to say in defense of fourth grade teachers that we work with, and we work with many, that there are teachers who really make a great effort to do as much as they can, given the fact that they actually have access to limited textbooks. Again, this is controlled by the State Education Department as to what textbooks are in their possession. But they do bring students to Ganondagan, to our site, to work with Native American interpreters, and they do, try to wrap their minds around the issues that were confronting people. Ganondagan is a 17th century site, so this is the whole story of the fur trade and events, leading up to it and how it impacted the development of the country afterward. So this is really, I commend them for the effort that they make. And I would just mention Fairport, Victor, Canandaigua as being schools. There are others as well, Pittsford, that really, send their students to see us, and we really work with them. But not every school, of course, across the state has near it a Native American historic site, nor does it have the people available perhaps to bring in who can supplement what the teacher knows about this. And then the teacher is left to their own devices. So that's where it gets very tricky, because it's, and then we you know, just recently I began to hear some of the kinds of things that have been on the standardized tests that are now being used, and you know, very confusing questions, really, that really try to avoid touching on anything that could be in the least bit controversial, actually. So a lot can be done. A lot needs to be done. I think that this is a subject that you could continue to teach, you know, over the course of a student's elementary and junior high courses, and integrate it into other subject matter, into other subject areas, and still keep it fresh and keep something, you know, interesting there, because after all, this is where people live. And the people originally living here knew a great deal about this country, and they, you know, and those are the things that were passed along to the original people who came here from other places in the world.
Professors, I have a question from Nicole online saying, where would the professor suggest I go to learn about Columbus with accuracy and depth? That's from Nicole online. Professor Schwaller, what do you think?
Well, certainly the standard biography was done by Samuel Eliot Morison back in the 40s. He was an admiral, as I remember, in the U.S. Navy who sought to duplicate the voyages, and he wrote really a prize-winning biography. More recently, Felipe Fernandez Armesto has written extensively on the on both Columbus and also on Amerigo Vespucci. So there's a pretty good bibliography out there, especially triggered by 92 when we had the quincentenary of the discovery.
And the question of how to teach our kids has been part of this discussion this hour. Then there's the question of whether Columbus Day should be celebrated at all or whether Indigenous Peoples Day is a better idea. Professors, before I let you go, do you sort of stand outside that debate, or John, do you take any position on that?
Well, I've lived many, many, many years in Mexico, and I always got enjoyed having Dia de la Raza, Day of the Race, and it was triggered, I think, as our colleague pointed out, by an essay that was actually written in the beginning of the 20th century by the then Secretary of Education in Mexico, a fellow by the name of Jose Vasconcelos, who talked about the cosmic race, that the Americas in general, both North and South America, are unique because we are the place where people from four different continents came together for the very first time. Asians, Americans, Africans, and Europeans all joined together. Yes, many of them under coercion, don't get me wrong, but the four continents came together for the first time here in the Americas, and that's something that we should celebrate. We should recognize the warts. We should also celebrate the successes. And so the idea of Day of the Race that they have in Mexico appeals to me on an intellectual level. One last thing about the Italians, and I think we all are equally proud of the Italians and their contribution to the United States. We have to remember that this is a very, very modern construct, that Italy did not exist until 1848 after the revolutions in Europe. Certainly in the time of Columbus, Genoa was culturally much closer to France and northern Spain than it was to the Papal States in central Italy. And Columbus himself worked many, many, many years, almost two decades for the Portuguese, before he came to work for the Spanish. So in today's geography, yes, he's Italian, but in that geography, he was Genoese. And he didn't even speak Italian. He spoke Genoese.
Professor Crabb, do you take a position on it?
I think the way I would, we haven't approached this in, when I do teach the what's called the Invention of the Americas, which is more or less the Colonial Latin America course. We haven't spent time talking about this. I mean, my position personally is that something like Indigenous Peoples Days is a start. At least there's a certain kind of recognition at the level of municipal and regional governments. But certainly it's not enough. And I think the danger always is that a history that is now, whose repercussions continue to exist now, tends to get overlooked, and the realities of the kind of contemporary situation that Native American peoples face, whether it's in Mexico or the United States or elsewhere, sometimes sometimes those things can get lost in the mix, and it's certainly only a starting point to have some kind of symbolic recognition like this. But there's actually real immediate work. Right? People need to be out supporting efforts to deal with broken treaties. They need to be out dealing with questions related to land occupations and so forth. And so it's a, as all of these things are, right, they have a certain kind of moment that can be politically important and politically empowering, but they can also very quickly descend into a kind of healthy congratulatory slap on the back, and then nothing changes. And that's always the concern.
Yeah.
It's people organizing and working together and moving on things, right?
Yeah.
To kind of deal with the repercussions.
Last word, I only got about 40 seconds. Peter Jemison, would you like to see it change?
Well, I would like to see, you know, more attention paid certainly to a truer history of, you know, of our experiences, you know, within what we now call New York State for Native people. That's, you know, and I think that discussion has to be with an older group of students. It can't just be with fourth graders. You know, I would say even at the high school level and at the college level. I'll just give one example, which is the Sullivan-Clinton campaign of 1779. That's not touched upon, generally speaking, at either junior high, high school, or even college level, unless you're really, you know, making an effort to study American history, where you find that whole story, which is, you know, a devastating campaign for our people.
Well, then I think that's one of the best points of the hour. Let's keep the education going, and whether one day out of the year is one thing, but yes, better education and more comprehensive. Peter, thank you for taking the time.
Evan, you're welcome.
And nice to talk to Professors Ray and John. Thank you both for taking the hour with us as well. We really appreciate that.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
John Schwaller, Ray Krebb from SUNY Albany and Cornell University. And thank you for listening on this Wednesday on member-supported public radio.